So we've got that going. And welcome, James. Good to see you.
Thank you, Doug. It's good to be here.
So it's time for us to take our meditation seats. And it's a pleasure once again to have this opportunity to sit with you and practice mindfulness, practice the Dharma. And so if it's if there's anything that could make things more comfortable for your meditation this evening, yeah, just to take a little careful attention to sitting posture and support, and to connect with the experience of this body, points of contact where we can feel the body in contact with the chair, cushion, perhaps feet resting on the floor. So a sense of being grounded and connected to just what's here in this moment. And if it's helpful to let your eyes close or just be softly downcast. And with a certain degree of deliberateness, intentionality, letting go of preoccupations from the day, just setting those worldly concerns aside as best you can. So to really let yourself come to rest here in the present moment as much as possible. And discover what's here. What is it that when we step out of sight of preconceived ideas, thinking, judgment, commentary, analysis, all of those things, what is it that we discover actually? We can start with being curious about the body and just to be aware of the contours of sensation that run through the body, places where there might be tightness or holding or tension, constriction, sometimes places that are quite familiar or habitual come into consciousness, and sometimes we discover something new, something fresh or unexpected. But to whatever degree, to hold the intention of kindness and to just allow some softening, maybe opening up some space for relaxation. Sometimes it might be in the hands or arms that we're holding on to tension or emotional energy. Or maybe it's more in the shoulders or the neck, or maybe higher up in the face, the forehead. Even the top of the head can be a place where we hold on to tension. So just checking in, noticing, being aware, and making the possibility of softening. Or it could be more to chest, diaphragm, belly. And if it seems helpful to take a long, slow, deep breath, to just let the experience of breathing be like a massage, so really breathing in slowly and really extending or maybe kind of exaggerating the exhalation to see if that invites a little bit more relaxation, a little opening, softening. And can receive the experience of the breath as just an invitation both to center and ground in the present moment with the body sensations of breathing, and also relax and maybe experience a little bit more ease, which is an important part of our practice. And to reflect on what we might take refuge in if we aren't focusing on clinging to things we like and getting the stuff we want or need, and we're not focused on avoiding or resisting unpleasant things, where do we find refuge? So the invitation with this practice is to see if it's possible to take refuge, to deepen in the experience of just being aware, being awake. That's taking refuge in the Buddha. And to see if it's helpful to take refuge in what we discover, the direct experience of truth that's beyond concepts and ideas, direct experience, which is what we're going to be focusing on later on this evening, really. It's where do we place faith or trust? And then there's taking refuge in our sense of being a part of something bigger, being connected, being a part of an inexorably intertwined universe. This piece of the living earth that we refer to as ourselves is connected up and a part of the community of life, the community that's gathered here this evening, taking refuge in the Sangha with each breath, with this breath. And so the practice is really to stay present with a primary focal point. And often that's the breath, as we just let the breath breathe itself. And so it isn't clinging to the breath, and it isn't going off in getting lost in tangents of daydreaming or analytical wanderings, but it's staying right here with this experience of embodied presence, to notice how the breath comes and goes of its own accord, and it reveals its presence in the form of body sensations, which we can discover fresh in each moment. So there is this balance in the present moment between welcoming what's here just as it is without clinging, without holding on, without resisting. And so centering in the breath can help us find that balance point, place where the mind starts to experience some equanimity, not being pulled this direction or that direction, but finding that kind of still point in the turning wheel of phenomenon, the ever-changing stream of sensation. It's kind of like a whirlpool of consciousness, of sensations, and we don't have to try and stop it. And we don't need to ignore it. It's just here, right here, this moment, there's a breath rising and falling. There's this body that sits. fosters a certain kind of faith or trust. If we hold the intention to be present, to return or stay with the most predominant object or the breath in the present moment, then all of the benefits that we seek will accrue from this practice. All of the wonderful things that we hear about mindfulness and about meditation come down to being present in this moment, this breath, these body sensations, these feelings, whatever they might be, whether they're pleasant or unpleasant or neutral. See, mindfulness is welcoming all states of consciousness, all feelings, all body sensations. kindness and patience and perseverance. Staying present, letting go of distractions, any identification with patterns of thinking or mental states or emotional states. It isn't trying to get rid of anything. It isn't about clinging to anything. It's really just being here with the way things are. And if there is simple words to describe it experientially, it might sound something like, it's like this. This is this moment, this breath, these body sensations, these feelings. And to be curious about what it would be like to really trust that being here in this moment with things being exactly as they are are the perfect conditions for our awakening. Nothing needs to be different. To trust that our path to awakening is always right here, this moment. So let's transition our focus, perhaps bringing more attention to seeing or moving into seeing, and let that, yeah, just be a gradual process, maybe noticing the region around the eyes, and with as much intention, mindful intention, as we can bring to notice eyelids opening, and to be present for seeing, knowing that seeing is happening. Perhaps it starts as a kind of pixelated jumble of stimuli and then becomes more coherent as the mind sort of makes sense of the incoming stimulation. So we can be present for that, noticing. So welcome to the space here this evening, Art of Freedom Meditation. And I'd like to invite you, if there's places where you're noticing any stiffness or tightness or tension in the body, to just take a moment, maybe to allow a little mindful attending, maybe a little stretch or movement, or maybe it's just feeling into it is enough. So we sit still for a while, bodies tend to sort of accumulate maybe some tension or constriction. So I'm checking in and seeing if that's true for you. And practicing kindness as we bring mindfulness to our experience, whatever's here. So I have a couple of announcements this evening. First is that Candleless Summers is going to be offering a day-long retreat on August 4th. That's from 10 to 4. It's the title of it escapes me, but it's something to do with the coming back to simple practice. Looks like a wonderful day, opportunity to practice. So that's at Portland Inside Meditation Community, and there's information on our website. Second is I'm going to be filling in for Candle this Sunday evening at 6:30 in her twice-a-month class, Metta and Insight. So if you'd like to tune in on Zoom on 6:30 on Sunday evening, you're more than welcome to join me there. And I think it's 6:30 to 8:30 on Sundays. Then I just wanted to mention also the practice of generosity, the practice of Dana, which is how we make things happen at PNIMC, at least in part, volunteer energy and financial contributions from the community that make us be able to pay the bills and do the things that we do. So I posted on the chat on Zoom a link to the virtual Dana Bowl. If you're tuning in on Facebook, you can find it on our Portland Insight Meditation Community website. I think there might be a link on Facebook as well. It's a wonderful way to find the joy of giving. Also, there's a link on the Zoom posting on chat for contacting me if you'd like to be on my email list for events and classes and retreats. So douglasblunt@gmail.com. So I'd like to check in, see if there's any sharing that would like to happen this evening. Anybody sitting with anything that's alive for you that would be helpful to share? If so, I could just take a moment to just check in, share, say our names, and then when you're finished, just say, I'm done, so the next person knows that it's their turn. Totally optional. Don't have to say a word if you don't want to. So I'll get us started. My name is Doug, and this evening I'm just experiencing the joy of being of service. I got a chance to be helpful to a friend earlier today with some difficult stuff that they were dealing with, and it felt really good. So just appreciating that, kind of savoring the ability to be of service. I have spoken. Thank you.
Okay, my name is Michelle, and when I came today, I was feeling very much alone. It reminded me of another time in my life where I felt very alone. And as we were going through the meditation, I was feeling very kind of relieved that I don't think I was as alone as I thought I was. It was a different kind of feeling. It was actually a nicer feeling than I wish I could have had the first time I felt like that during the time. Anyways, I'm done. Thank you.
Thanks. So just to check, anybody just on the edge of sharing? Susan.
I can share that.
Okay, great.
I had an experience a little bit like yours, or have been having. My grandchild was just born, now it's 4 weeks tomorrow. He's 4 weeks old, but he's been... very difficult baby to get settled into sleep and stay asleep. And so my son and daughter-in-law have been just really struggling to sort of hand him back and forth between themselves and try to get enough sleep. And I've been just helping out and taking him, and today was just a particularly nice stretch of time where I took him and got him to sleep, took him over to my place because they live next door, and got him to sleep, and he slept for like almost 3 hours quietly. So, and I just kept him right next to me on the couch. It was just really sweet time, and I was glad to let him have a break. That's it. I'm done.
Thanks. To share with you a poem and a Dharma reflection, and then there might be some time for some more sharing or questions. This is a Kabir poem. It's called The Revolution. There is nothing but water in the holy pools. I know. I've been swimming in them. All of the gods sculpted of wood and ivory can't say a word. I know. I've been crying out to them. The sacred books of the East are nothing but words. I look through their covers one day sideways. What Kabir talks about is only what he's lived through. If you haven't lived through something, it is not true. What Kabir talks about is only what he's lived through. If you haven't lived through something, it is not true. So, the focus for this evening is on something that's referred to in the Buddhist tradition as faith. And that may conjure up, if you have been brought up in a Western Christian or Jewish tradition, the faith in a deity, the kind of monotheistic belief in a god or a deity. That's the kind of faith that we often are exposed to in this culture. In Buddhism, the word faith means something quite different. So it is a conviction or faith or trust based on direct experience, based on what we discover from our own observation. And it's considered one of the five spiritual faculties or powers in Dharma teaching. It goes along with energy or effort, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. So those are the five spiritual powers. It's sometimes in some Buddhist practice, it's expressed in the act of taking refuge in awareness, taking refuge in the direct experience of truth, taking refuge in inner being or interconnectedness. And it's sometimes said to function in the form of a kind of a motor that propels Buddhist practitioners, meditators, to the goal of awakening or experiencing the truth. So it isn't based on blind faith. Stephen Batchelor said, and I shared this quote in the announcement I sent out, but I think it's worth reading. He said, faith isn't the equivalence of mere belief. It's the condition of ultimate confidence that we have the capacity to follow the path of doubt to its end. Faith in the Buddhist understanding is not the opposite of doubt. Faith is embracing doubt with mindfulness and wise reflection. It's bringing doubt to wise counsel. So when doubts arise in the mind, there's an invitation to be curious. So what's this about? Maybe I need to get some questions answered. Maybe I need to do further investigation. What is it based on? And then taking it a bit further, Alan Watts said, belief is the insistence that the truth is what we would will or wish it to be. Faith is an unreserved opening of the mind to the truth. To the truth, whatever it may turn out to be. Faith has no preconceptions. It's a plunge into the unknown. Belief clings, but faith lets go. Faith is the essential virtue of science. And likewise, any religion that isn't self-deception. Um, So back some 10 or 15 years ago, the Dalai Lama was being interviewed. His Holiness was asked a question. So what if science proved an aspect of the Buddhist teaching inaccurate? And he said, well, we'd probably have to change the Buddhist teaching, which is an interesting perspective. So there's something about that taking refuge in the truth, taking refuge in Dharma, that's a part of faith. It's an essential piece. So it comes as trust in the direct experience, discovering for ourselves what's true. And the experience of our essential nature. What is that? Well, we can use words to try to describe it, but ultimately it's indescribable. It can only be experienced. That's therefore the reason for the focus on experiential understanding. There is no Buddhist understanding without meditation. Doctrines, suttas, texts can be useful for understanding, but there's no way we can really truly understand it without discovering it for ourselves. That's what it comes down to. So from a Buddhist perspective, from a Dharma perspective, faith in some kind of mythological understanding is a kind of shaky and impermanent place to put our faith. It's not really a reliable foundation. So in Dharma practice, faith arises from being able to train the mind to be astute and accurate and penetrating in its understanding. That's what the variety of meditation practices are for, is to hone that capacity to peel away the layers of delusion and distraction. So we can actually experience the essential nature of life. And to examine the phenomenal life objectively, studying the effects, tracing their causes. You could say that the Buddha produced a science of living which ranks with any major science known to us. You could say that we bring a kind of scientific attitude to the study of one, this individual consciousness. As we go deeply into it, we discover that maybe it isn't so individual or separate. So where does this come from in the Buddhist teachings, this idea of faith? Well, it shows up in lots of different places. One of the places we find it comes from the Buddha's wanderings. He was a mendicant wandering spiritual teacher in India back 2,600 years ago. And as the story goes from one of the sutta here is called the Kalama Sutta. And he came upon this village of the Kalamas, who were religious seekers themselves. And there, back in the day, there was a veritable smorgasbord. I realize I'm kind of mixing cultural references there, but there was a veritable smorgasbord of spiritual practices. All kinds of things were being taught and practiced in India back then. And there was, yeah, these divergent philosophies and teachers vying for this village's attention. And they would often disparage or put down the other teachers and say, no, I've got the right answer. You should listen to me. Kind of like politicians today in some way, I suppose. He offered his teachings to these villagers. They kind of had enough. They were kind of fed up. They voiced their doubts and their perplexity in determining the truth or falsehood. It's like, yeah, okay, you're the 10th teacher that's come through here this month. Why should we believe you? Why should we take your word for it? And he said, this is in quotes from the sutta, he said, don't take my word for it. Don't be led by reports or tradition or hearsay. Don't be led by the authority even of religious texts, nor by mere logic or inference, nor by considering appearances, all of which eliminate exclusive reliance on cultural convention, received tradition, deductive speculation, and so on. Don't take any teacher's word for it just because they have charisma or there's a lot of people who are following them. He's basically said, discover for yourself what works, what leads to your own welfare and the welfare of others, what actually does reduce suffering, reduce the sense of dissatisfaction, the sense of being annoyed or stressed or disquieted. What actually works when you put it to practice, when you put it to the test? What leads to peace and compassion? What helps you become more loving, ultimately? And then going back to quoting, O Kalamas, when you know for yourselves that certain things are wholesome and certain things are unwholesome, then give up the unwholesome and practice the wholesome. When you know certain things are beneficial and certain things aren't, then use your own discerning, wisdom. So the Buddha's advice was not to depend on theories or cults or gurus or teachers. We must remain masters of ourselves. So in this Theravada tradition, teachers aren't gurus. We're just regular fallible human beings like everybody else. Perhaps we've been practicing longer and have a bit more wisdom and resources and knowledge to offer, but the ultimate teaching is you're the teacher. To help you become your own teacher and to discover for yourself what's true. He said, if you wish to see the end of your own dukkha, suffering, discontent, and fear, develop discipline, compassion, and wisdom. That's the message, really. And so that involves, and the discipline is regular practice, some form, regular meditation, compassion, to be tender and kind with ourselves and others, and wisdom, discriminating wisdom is really that quality of discernment what's skillful and what isn't skillful. What's the nature of life in the present moment? Impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, and self as a aggregated thing rather than a solid, separate experience. So faith is what arises when we discover for ourselves what's true. There's a strong emphasis, kind of subterranean, sort of under the surface, I guess, in our culture, for us not to trust ourselves. It makes us easier to be manipulated by the powers that be. There's systems of thought, spiritual practice that are based on the idea that you can't really trust your true nature, your basic nature. Don't trust it. Trust what's in this book, or trust what these teachers or these people in power are telling you. Don't trust. I mean, it's even in Western psychology, in Freudian psychology, there's the id, ego, and superego. And the id is our sort of fundamental animalistic nature, which can't be trusted. Or there's original sin in Christianity. You can't really trust what you're born with. Circling back to Alan Watts, he said in one of his books, if you cannot trust yourself, your essential nature, your true nature, then how can you trust your mistrust of yourself? Which is an interesting conundrum. So that without this underlying trust in our nature, in our essential nature, discovering what our essential nature is, he said, our whole experience then becomes paralyzed. We become confused, depressed, paralyzed, and disempowered. So the message in the Dharma is really about empowerment and trust in that. And there's a strong feature in Buddhism is the importance it attaches to democratic ideals. Unhindered discussions are encouraged, even when there's contrary views. There's the quote from the Buddha just before he died. He said on his dying bed, be a lamp unto yourself, be a refuge unto yourself. So that's the invitation. So you could say following the Dharma, following this path, means following the path of embracing doubt and uncertainty. The middle path, the path of the Dharma, is the path that each of us can take to find the truth, eschewing extremes. It's a very personal path. Everybody starts in different place, and finding the balance that leads to that is, we can start with the universal practices, but then we have to apply them to our own individual experience and learn to do that in a way that does lead to more freedom. And to discover how it is that we do that. Thich Nhat Hanh, the Vietnamese Zen master, said in the Thip Hanh precepts, the precepts on the order of inner being, do not be an idolatrous or bound to any doctrine, theory, or ideology, even Buddhist ones, Buddhist systems of thought are guiding means. They're not absolute truth. The teachings of the Buddha are considered to be a raft that help us cross the river of samsara, the river of dukkha, the river of confusion. They're a useful tool, but once we reach the other side, we don't need to carry the raft around on our backs. So we don't even need to cling to the Dharma, ultimately. Nothing is to be clung to. We use it as skillful means until we get the results that are that we're looking for, that are beneficial. So, just in conclusion here, faith in the Theravada Buddhist tradition is generally a confidence based on first-hand understanding or direct experience, especially that arises from meditation through deep inquiry. Faith in the workings of karma, that there is cause and effect and understanding. Faith in our ownership of our own actions. Faith in that we can cultivate qualities of heart and mind that reduce suffering that comes from direct experience. I'd like to share a quote from Sharon Salzberg. She is one of the pioneering Vipassana teachers, Western teachers, that helped found the Insight Meditation Society. She said, "It is a great turning point in our spiritual lives when we go from an intellectual appreciation of a path to a heartfelt confidence that says, yes, it's possible to awaken, I can too. A tremendous joy accompanies this confidence. When we place our hearts upon the practice, the teachings come alive. That turning point, which is transformative, transforms an aspect of practice that's abstract, conceptual, into a spiritual path of personal faith and direct experience." So, we can experience that for ourselves. So, faith is the seed, practice is the rain, wisdom is the yoke and the plow, modesty is the pole, mind the strap, mindfulness my plowshare and my goad. That's from the Samanya Nikaya Sutta. Actually, it's the, I'm not sure I can pronounce it, the Kassabhavadavadaya Sutta in the Samyutta Nikaya. So, for those who are interested in the original text. So, this evening I have a kind of a guided reflection for us, totally optional, if it seems helpful. You can also just do a little bit more grounding and centering in the breath. If you feel like you just need that more than a guided reflection. So checking in, once again, trusting your own inner wisdom, your inner guidance, what's helpful for you this evening. So this is going to be a series of questions to just notice what comes up. But to start with, to center in the breath and return, to just knowing in this moment what's true, checking in, connecting. So the first question is, What do you know from your own direct experience about the nature of life, about the way life works? What do you know? What do you know from your own direct experience, not from a book or from something that someone else told you, but from your own experience about the nature of life and the way life works? And just notice what comes up. And we can bring mindfulness to this inquiry, into this reflection. So if there's any commentary or judgment or any of those kinds of things, we could just note those and let those go and return to just what is it that we discover. And it's okay if nothing comes up, but maybe there's a lot of things that come up. So just being open. What do we really know from our own direct experience about the nature of life, the way life works? So a second question, so we're in a transition, letting this first question go. Where do you place faith in your life? What do you have faith in? And just notice what comes to mind. And this might come in the form of images or feelings or memories, body sensations, or some combination. Yeah, so just noticing. And then a third question. So letting go of the second question. Third question is, what do you have confidence in? What do you really have confidence in? Noticing what comes up. And letting this third question go. And then a fourth question. What do you really understand to be true? What do you really understand or stand under to be true? Noticing what happens in the body, what happens in the heart and mind. Just noticing what comes up, and then letting this last question go, And just sitting here for a few consecutive breaths. Yeah, just noticing what's most alive, what's happening. And then check in and see if there's anything that you'd like to share or any question that comes up. Of course, it's totally optional. Yeah. So anyone like to share what you noticed?
Yeah. I noticed that. What was true was that we all, our thoughts of independence are, that we're all dependent upon each other. Like the clothes that are on the back, the food that is on my plate, it's picked by another person, and I'm dependent on them, and they're dependent upon me. And the idea that we can just run our own lives and independently, can be foolish sometimes.
Yeah, the truth of interdependency, yeah. Yeah, that's a great insight.
Thanks.
Doug, what was the very first question again?
First question is, what do we know from our direct experience, or what do you know from your direct experience about the nature of life and the way life works?
Yeah, that question, the first thing that popped into my head was just that it's up and down.
Mm-hmm.
That life works in a way that it, you know, it's just up and down. It's good, it's bad, it's...
Mm-hmm.
And the next thought I had was that when I look at another person and their situation, and for whatever reason I may be jealous or envious, whatever it is I think I see, you know, whether it's, I don't know, somebody has a nicer house than I do, or somebody has a partner and I'm single, or whatever it is, somebody gets to travel a lot or something. But whenever I'm doing that, I've lost the awareness that I have absolutely no idea what else is going on, what kind of suffering they may be having that it's just impossible as you look around the world to know the kind of suffering that everyone you see is experiencing.
Hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, it's so true.
Yeah.
Yeah. And even though we don't know what exactly their suffering is, we know the experience of suffering or dukkha is universal.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, Susan, is it almost like you look at a two-dimensional thing and then actually reality just more dimensions? It's almost like you're kind of a flatlander, if you know what I mean, when you're that jealous state.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Exactly. Yes. You have blinders on. There's just this one thing that you see. Yeah.
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 Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So this opens the door to more depth, multidimensional understanding. Yeah.
Yeah, and to just really a further commitment to kindness, because you have no idea what people are burdened with. They may seem fine, you know, they may seem happy, they may seem like they have everything, but you don't have a clue. And you know they're suffering somewhere, somehow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I found Stephen Batchelor's take on doubt to be really helpful for me. He's the author of a book, and he's a Buddhist teacher, or author of many books. One of his books is Buddhism Without Beliefs. And he doesn't define doubt as, in the traditional sense of kind of wavering indecision. He interprets doubt as to keep alive the perplexity at the heart of our lives, to acknowledge that fundamentally we don't really know what's going on some level. And that kind of ties in with what you were saying, Susan, about what's going on with other people. I've found a lot of times people that have social anxiety, for example, there's a part of their pattern of thinking that believes that it knows what other people are thinking about them, and it's almost always negative. And so even to just be aware of that, those patterns of negative thinking, and to notice that actually we really don't know, and to hold it with a question mark, can be a process of reducing or kind of diffusing from some of that kind of anxiety thinking, for example. I really don't know what other people are thinking unless they tell me. Being preoccupied and concerned about that doesn't really do me any good. So it really isn't any of my business, in a way. So just bringing that note of doubt in there can actually be really helpful. If we think we know things, then we stop being curious. We stop being open to new discoveries. There's another talk that I've given about beginner's mind. And beginner's mind is really a mind that's open and willing to be here with discovering something new, fresh. And that's really what mindfulness is about, or that's one of the things that it's about, to show up here in the present moment. Outside of preconceived ideas, and actually be open instead of believing that I already know everything. Stephen Batchelor draws on the Zen tradition, in which there's three factors to obtaining enlightenment, and those are great faith, great doubt, and great courage. He explains the connection of these three in the following way. He said, the acceptance of doubt as basic to keeping Buddhist practice qualities that the meaning of faith is not equivalent to mere belief. faith is the condition of ultimate confidence that we have the capacity to follow the path of doubt to its end. And it's not the opposite of doubt. And everything changes. So the things that we think we know are based on past experience. But we can't really predict how they're going to change sometimes. People change, we change. Everything's in flux, except our concepts and ideas, perhaps, that are fixed. So I'm going to wrap up there, unless there's any other sharing or comments or questions before we close. Yeah.
I have one further thought.
Okay.
Of what I was saying before, that not only do I not, if I feel a spark of jealousy because of something someone appears to be enjoying, not only do I not know what burdens they have, but also whatever good is happening with them is impermanent. And I can more easily go to altruistic joy if I have that sense that their life is a mixed bag, just like everybody's, and whatever is happening that's great for them is going to change, and I can just be happy for them in this moment.
Yeah, it's beautiful. That's beautiful. Yeah.
Thanks.
In this human existence of earthly toil, where there's all the conditions for dukkha, if someone's experiencing joy in any moment, well, that's wonderful, because we know it's fleeting. It's,
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's great.
Thank you.
Plus, you can have joy with their joy in a way. It's weird. You can still have jealousy, but you can have joy at the same time, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, it totally does.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we've touched on heart cultivation here, which is a great segue into closing, doing a closing, which can't be just reflecting on what would be wonderful to cultivate as an intention of kindness for yourself, noticing what's alive for you this evening or in this day, and what would you like to wish for yourself or cultivate in your heart. And it might be that quality of altruistic joy, or maybe it's more of some compassion for struggles or challenges that you're facing or that loved ones are facing. Maybe it's more just kind of to be unperturbed, to have equanimity. Or maybe just a general sense of friendliness and kindness in the form of loving kindness. So noticing what that might be, and if there are some words or a felt sense that you'd like to focus on here for just a few minutes with the support of the group. What does your heart long to hear? What would bring balance to this heart and mind? For example, may I be peaceful? May I be free from fear? May I have physical health and well-being, or mental health well-being? Those are just a few examples. And to offer this in the form of some focus and a little bit of repetition, perhaps, letting it radiate throughout your being. is how that feels. Sometimes there is a warmth or a tingling or a felt sense. And maybe there isn't. Maybe it's more planting seeds of intention, mental intention. And that's great too. It's totally fine. And as is true with all of these heart cultivation Brahmavihara practices, they are illimitable, and there's a natural moving out into the world to be with those other beings who are near and dear to us that we might wish to think of and include in our circle, our virtual circle of kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, equanimity. So I can imagine those wishes going out to those loved ones, those dear friends, family. It's a sense of the circle of loving energy moving out, including our Sangha gathered here this evening, our community on Zoom and Facebook. And then letting these energies, these loving intentions move out into the world. You can imagine or visualize or have a felt sense of moving to the north, into the south, into the east, into the west, to all beings, known and unknown, human beings, beings of the air, the land, waters, seen and unseen, to the farthest reaches of the universe, to all beings everywhere. May all beings be free and come to the Great Awakening. And you're welcome to join me, if you'd like, on Zoom in chanting, as we chant here at the end. So the chant is, may all beings be happy. And we can do that three times. And then sadhu, which means so be it three times. So yeah, welcome to unmute, totally optional. So let's give this a try. May all beings be happy. May all beings be happy. May all beings be happy. Sadhu. 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 Beautiful. Thank you. Thank you all so much for being here this evening. It's a smaller group, but very sweet. And so I'm grateful. And take whatever's good from our practice and continue to practice with it. Anything that's not helpful, just let it go. Trust your own guidance, your own inner teacher. And be safe and well. And I hope to see you again next week. And if you'd like to tune in on Sunday, I'll be there on Candle's Zoom link for the Metta and Insight, 6:30. So take care, everybody.
Thanks.
Thanks, Doug.
Thank you.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night.
Thanks, folks on Facebook. Have a good evening. Take care.